This podcast is designed for the purpose of entertainment and information and is not meant to be considered medical advice.
What? It's not?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, our lawyer said we can't do that anymore.
Aww. And I'll have a milkshake, please. Thanks.
That's not exactly healthy, you know.
Every once in a while. Plus, I'm not the one who's lactose intolerant.
Well, given the plastic chairs and the curling linoleum, this may be the type of place that doesn't actually use milk in their milkshakes.
Well, time will tell.
Besides, haven't you heard that cow's milk is for baby cows and human milk is for baby humans?
I don't think they'll make a milkshake from breast milk.
That wasn't what I was suggesting.
That's good. No, I'm sure there's a specialty restaurant somewhere that serves breast milk.
Well, let me just check. Yep, New York City restaurant serves breast milk cheese. The free market has gone too far.
You know, I was kind of joking about that. Good grief.
Well, I guess there's technically nothing wrong with consuming breast milk as an adult, I suppose.
Well, there's nothing particularly right about it either.
So do you think we're going to see more adults drinking breast milk now?
I hope not. It's enough of a challenge trying to get newborns to drink breast milk.
What's the evidence like? I mean, isn't the evidence for the health benefits of breast milk, like, a little bit shaky?
Well, it depends what you mean by shaky.
Well, if you had children, would you want them to be breastfed?
Why? Do you know somebody who wants to settle down?
Yes, I know people who want to settle down.
With me?
No. You said you were paying for all this, right? I think I'll get the chocolate lava cake. Like, the whole thing? Oh, can you pay for my lactate, too? It's a show about medicine.
With 20% more fiber.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead, jeez.
And we're gonna look at the evidence behind medical topics, and the show is
called... Wait, no, I wanna say it.
I wanna say it.
I came up with it. It's the body of...
Body of evidence.
It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to another edition of The Body of Evidence, the show that nourishes your mind by telling you how to nourish your body.
Because there is only one right way to eat, and for a fee, we will tell you what that right way is.
No.
Right. I forgot. Orthorexia isn't a thing.
I mean, it's a thing. It's just not a thing to be encouraged. That voice you just heard before mine just now is that of my co-host, Dr. Christopher Labos, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and man who can't help trying to leverage this podcast for a quick buck.
And sitting to my virtual left because cases are rising in our neck of the woods is Jonathan Jarry, podcaster, science communicator, and man whose ethics all but guarantee that he will die in poverty, a broken and forgotten man, alone and unloved.
Wow. Dark. Like the show, which was excellent. Babies. Let's talk about babies and what to feed them. I'm guessing there is a right way of feeding a baby and a wrong way.
Well, best to avoid chili dogs.
Agreed. But I guess the question is whether you should go with breastfeeding or formula.
Not an uncommon question, to be sure.
Okay, so let's start with what the professional guidelines recommend.
Right. So people almost unanimously recommend breastfeeding.
Sweet. We're done. I guess we're finishing early this week.
Although they do disagree on some points. So the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, the World Health Organization, and the Canadian Pediatric Society all recommend that newborns be breastfed. The question becomes, for how long?
Isn't it 6 months?
Yeah, exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months, and most groups say up to 1 year, although the WHO says up to 2 years, and the Canadian guidelines say keep doing it for as long as you want, pretty much.
I was watching a very evidence-based documentary on Netflix about this, where Mongolians were being breastfed until the age of 6, which I found shocking, but isn't even 2 years, as the WHO suggests, a little old to be breastfeeding?
Well, actually, the reality is that after 6 months, breast milk does not meet the nutritional needs of babies anymore. You need to start solid foods, and that is generally when parents start to introduce it into their children's diet.
And you introduce foods one at a time to monitor for allergies and intolerance, right?
Exactly. So over a period of 6 to 12 months, you increase the amount of solid food and, you know, by necessity, decrease the amount of breast milk that makes up the diet.
So it's a question of how quickly you taper off the breastfeeding, and in some cultures, that tapering off is a bit or even much slower.
Right. And compared to other parts of the world, breastfeeding has not been popular in North America.
Wait, are you saying that most infants are not breastfed in North America?
Yeah. I mean, do you want to take a guess at what percentage of infants are exclusively breastfed for 6 months as per guidelines?
Presumably some mothers can't breastfeed for medical reasons or because a baby can't breastfeed properly, like it doesn't latch on correctly, or maybe there's insufficient milk production.
Yeah, no, absolutely, for sure, that happens. Yeah.
I'll guess 80% are breastfed. Let's say 70 to 80%, somewhere in there.
Yeah, it's 25%.
Wow, that is much lower than I expected.
Yeah, I know. So about 80% of infants get some breast milk for some period of time, but very few get it exclusively for 6 months, as recommended.
Suddenly, the motivation behind all of those breast is best campaigns, it makes a bit more sense.
Yeah, they are very much motivated by pediatric societies that see breastfeeding levels far below what they think they should be.
I had this sense, maybe from watching Mongolian children being breastfed at disturbingly old ages, that breastfeeding was fairly universal.
Well, actually, no. In the early 1900s, it was, obviously. But the popularity of breastfeeding really started to fall throughout the 20th century. The low point was 1972, when only about 20% of new mothers breastfed their babies.
Was there a reason for this?
I mean, probably not any one reason. Infant formulas came on the market, more women were giving birth in hospitals, so there was more of a disconnect between mothers and newborn babies.
Wait a minute. You can still give birth in a hospital and breastfeed a baby.
Well, not in the early 1900s you couldn't. Babies and mothers were frequently separated after birth, and hospitals had formula on hand to feed babies at fixed times in their centralized nurseries.
And the mothers were where?
Well, they were frequently sedated.
Well, I mean, women get epidurals now. Is that...
No, I don't mean epidural. I mean full-on sedation with morphine, like what they used to call the twilight sleep.
I see. That sounds dangerous.
It was. One of its leading advocates died during childbirth. So anyway, the medicalization of childbirth in the early 20th century made, you know, breastfeeding less common. And, you know, at the same time, you had more women entering the workforce throughout the 20th century, so that also played a role.
So the public health campaigns to increase breastfeeding were more about reversing the steady decline that had been seen for the past 100 years.
Right, and prior to the last part of the 20th century, nobody really talked about the medical benefits of breastfeeding. So the push was really about getting people to readopt the practice of breastfeeding newborns, you know, for at least the first 6 months of life.
But are these touted medical benefits real? I mean, how certain are we that breast milk is, in fact, better?
We're kind of certain.
Kind of?
Well, we have to remember that when you say, is breast milk better, you have to ask, better than what? Better than cow's milk? Better than a specially designed infant formula? Or do you mean comparing babies breastfed for 6 months versus 3 months?
I'm guessing the research is a bit heterogeneous, unlike milk, which is homogenized.
It is indeed heterogeneous, yes.
Okay, well, roll up your sleeves, because when we come back, we're going to sift through the evidence and find out how much weight we should put to the claims that breastfeeding is actually better.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to go put on a tank top.
No, you can't roll the on a tank. You can, and no one needs to see. We'll be right back.
This episode of The Body of Evidence is brought to you in part by Billy Bob Papillon's Ultimate Relaxation Album. In this age of heightened anxiety, treat yourself to the calming soundscapes of Billy Bob Papillon. Here's an excerpt from his track, South Pole Calming Nirvana. Billy Bob Papillon is a multi-instrumentalist who traveled the world to bring you the most relaxing sounds ever made. He has worked in close contact with hypersensitive individuals who cannot tolerate music to bring them soothing tracks like this gem entitled Calmer Than a Gentle Pond in the Winter. Billy Bob Papillon's Ultimate Relaxation Album. And don't miss his previous platinum album, My 7-Hour Journey into White Noise.
Hello, podcast listeners. Today we've been talking about breastfeeding and why it's actually much less popular than people realize.
Though, to be fair, breastfeeding rates are rising.
But is it really better than the bottle?
By which you mean formula, not alcohol, correct?
Correct. Do not give alcohol to your newborn. I'm not a pediatrician, but even I know not to load your baby up with Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Right. So, okay. Overall, we should acknowledge the widespread consensus that breastfeeding and exclusive breastfeeding should be encouraged for the first 6 months of life.
Yeah, but the consensus could be the work of the Illuminati, who want to keep the masses of people subservient to big business, also known as Big Titty. That's its official conspiracy name. I'm sticking to it.
But if they wanted to keep people subservient to big business, wouldn't they be promoting formula, not breastfeeding? Like, wouldn't they be big bottle?
It's a conspiracy theory. It doesn't have to make sense.
Right. So anyway, we have to ask two questions. What are the benefits to the baby? And what are the benefits to the mother?
Okay, so let's take the baby. What makes breast milk so good for them?
Well, apart from containing water, protein, fat, and sugar, you know, for energy and growth and all that, breast milk also contains antibodies, hormones, growth factors, and all kinds of stuff that help protect the baby and prevent certain diseases.
Okay, but let's be specific and see what the evidence base is for each of these claims. Now, people claim that breastfeeding has a calming effect on the baby and might even have an analgesic effect, meaning that it reduces the pain.
Yeah, so there was a randomized study in pediatrics in 2002 that compared breastfeeding versus usual care when babies went for blood tests. And the group that was breastfeeding, during the blood test, had less pain in the sense that they were crying less and their heart rate didn't shoot up as much.
But that could have been just from being held by their mothers during the feeding, though.
True, but there was a later study in the BMJ in 2003 where they looked at breastfeeding versus just being held in the mother's arms as a control, and breastfeeding still did better.
But no real placebo-controlled study, though.
Well, in 2008, Pediatrics published a study comparing breastfeeding to an oral sugar solution when they did blood tests on the babies. And the breastfed babies did better on the pain score charts and cried less during the needle pricks.
And why is this happening?
Well, there's a lot of different reasons. I mean, it's partly the skin-to-skin contact. There was actually a Cochrane review in 2017 about skin-to-skin contact, and the conclusion was that it did help. And part of it is the soothing sensation of body warmth. You know, warm touch also helps soothe babies.
Okay, so probably a few different mechanisms at play here, but it does seem as if breast milk itself has sedative properties, although I guess they never compare it to infant formula. I mean, even that 2008 study you just talked about was just breastfeeding versus a sugar solution.
That's true.
Any other immediate benefits to breastfeeding?
Well, for premature infants, there is a clear benefit. So when a baby is born premature and when breastfeeding isn't an option, you either have to use formula or donor breast milk.
And these have been compared head-to-head?
Yes. Yeah. So there was a 2019 Cochrane review that looked at this question, and it found that the formula group had, you know, slightly faster weight gain, but it came at nearly double the risk of NEC, necrotizing enterocolitis.
I don't know what that is, but it sounds really bad.
It is. It's a condition that affects premature babies, where essentially the intestine doesn't develop properly and starts breaking down. Breast milk, because it contains certain growth factors, seems to help prevent that.
But if your baby is born at term, that's not really a concern, is it?
Not really, no.
Still, though, I mean, there seems to be good evidence from randomized clinical trials that breastfeeding has clear medical benefits for the baby. I'm looking forward to reviewing all of the other randomized trials that suggest that breastfeeding helps protect babies against infections and has long-term benefits in terms of IQ scores, obesity, and cancer.
Ooh.
What?
Okay, you should probably brace yourself because it kind of goes downhill from here.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Now, there are two good WHO systematic reviews on the short and long-term benefits of breastfeeding.
Okay.
And they concluded that breastfeeding has a clear benefit in terms of preventing infections, mainly diarrheal and respiratory infections.
Because presumably breast milk has antibodies and white blood cells that are passed on from mother to baby.
Right.
And how certain are they?
Well, they're pretty certain, and you have dozens of studies supporting this assertion.
Randomized control trials.
Well, no. So it's mostly from observational cohorts.
Well, then that's troubling, because as we have said many, many times on the show, we want data from good quality randomized control trials.
Yeah, well, I want to be married to a supermodel that likes doing escape rooms. Sometimes life throws you a curveball and you have to adapt. I mean, the evidence is pretty uniformly positive that breastfeeding protects against acute infections, but yeah, it is all from observational studies.
So this could be the result of confounding.
Yeah, it could. And a real big problem with all of this research is that it could be due to reverse causality.
Right. So rather than A causing B, B actually causes A.
Right. So you look at babies that get sick and discover that, you know, they aren't being breastfed. So you say, babies that aren't breastfed are more likely to get sick. But maybe the babies got sick and their mother stopped breastfeeding them because they were sick. So it makes it look like breastfeeding is protective when in fact it isn't.
So what if I want randomized trial data before I make a decision about breastfeeding?
Well, if you have $20 million, I can make that happen, no problem.
$20 million?
Well, maybe 10 if I buy the cheap coffee for the office.
I see. I might have five. Would five do? So is there any evidence that breastfeeding prevents infant death, which is a pretty hard endpoint?
Yes, there is. I mean, it's just that it comes from observational cohorts, not from randomized trials.
Okay. What about all the claims that breastfeeding is associated with less obesity and higher IQ and all that? Putting aside the issues with IQ as a measurement for now, is this all from observational cohorts too?
Yeah. And the problem here is that these studies tend to come from developed nations where breastfeeding is associated with higher economic status. So, you know, that's a confounder. Then, you know, if you're asking the mother of a five-year-old if their children were breastfed, recall bias becomes a problem. I mean, you're more likely to remember that your mathlete was breastfed.
So again, the possibility that all this was just from confounding.
Yeah. Now, for the obesity question, there was one randomized trial from Belarus, and that was published in JAMA in 2013, where they tested a program to encourage breastfeeding, and that had no effect on obesity in children at age 11.
Not encouraging, although testing a program to encourage breastfeeding isn't quite the same as testing breast milk versus formula, though, because all you really proved is that the program didn't have an effect. Not necessarily that breast milk is non-beneficial.
That's true, yeah.
And people make claims that, you know, breastfeeding reduces the risk of type 1 diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease, asthma, and dental cavities. Are you telling me that all of that is from observational research as well?
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, next you're going to tell me that breastfeeding doesn't really improve your IQ.
Well, even the supportive studies only show like a 3-point improvement in IQ, which is probably not meaningful. And reviews like the Cochrane review we mentioned before on donor breast milk versus formula in preemies, that did not show an improvement in neurodevelopmental outcomes.
So the studies that showed a benefit were probably due to confounding.
Probably. I mean, when you do sibling studies, so when you compare two siblings or twins, which is even better, one who was breastfed and one who wasn't, that cuts down on the confounding quite a bit. And those types of studies tend not to show a benefit or show a lesser benefit.
Because siblings are likely to be pretty much similar in all that background stuff that can confound the association between breastfeeding and IQ. Same parents, same household income, same educational opportunities, etc.
Exactly.
You know, we still haven't talked about the benefits, real or imagined, of breastfeeding for the mother.
Yeah, so there is some data on the health benefits of breastfeeding to mothers.
Should I brace myself for disappointment?
I mean, yes, I think you should always do that year round. I mean, it's a pretty good safety mechanism for life.
Who hurt you so badly that you just can't feel joy anymore?
Well, that's not important right now. But you know, look, breastfeeding mothers have higher levels of oxytocin, and oxytocin helps limit postpartum blood loss by helping the uterus to contract.
Is that a real concern in this day and age? I mean, given that most people give birth in hospitals?
I wouldn't think so intuitively, but, you know, it's there. That's the data for what it's worth. And also, breastfeeding delays the resumption of ovulation. So it's like a form of birth control.
Yeah, but I mean, we already have a form of birth control. It's called birth control. Plus, my understanding is that most people who have a new baby are just so exhausted that any free time they have is spent sleeping, not having sex.
True, but in parts of the world where birth control is not readily accessible, it may have its uses.
Okay, but are there any direct health benefits to the mother regarding, you know, less cancer or heart disease?
Well, there have been studies suggesting decreased risks of cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes.
Is this also from observational studies?
Yes, pretty much.
Okay.
Now, the one thing that is often talked about is weight loss, you know, how breastfeeding helps women return to their pre-pregnancy weight faster.
Is that not true?
The data is surprisingly inconsistent. Intuitively, it should make sense. It takes metabolic energy to produce breast milk, you know, for the baby to drink. So, you know, if you exclusively breastfeed your infant, everything they need to grow is being taken from the mother.
So they're like a giant parasite.
Not the most eloquent way to put it, but yes. And yet, even though that makes total intuitive sense, the data is somewhat equivocal.
Well, weight loss is dependent on so many different factors, right? I mean, so after a pregnancy, you're probably not exercising as much, probably not eating as healthily as before because your sleep schedule is all screwed up. Maybe you're eating more to compensate for the energy spent on making breast milk.
Right. I mean, so, you know, it may help a little, but other factors determine, you know, how much weight loss actually occurs postpartum. So it's probably a combination of things.
So it doesn't sound as if there's much evidence to back the recommendations to breastfeed your children.
Well, there's one thing you have to remember about breastfeeding. It's free. And you can make as much of it as you need, provided you, you know, biologically can. And you don't need a fridge to store it in. You don't need to mix it with water, so you don't have to worry about the lack of clean drinking water where you live. You know, globally, breastfeeding has huge economic benefits, both for the individual and for society.
How much are we talking here?
Well, formula can run you maybe $2,000 per year.
Wow. Yeah. You know, it had never, ever occurred to me, but babies are expensive.
But economic estimates suggest that breastfeeding saves society billions of dollars. I mean, especially in low-income countries where they have the most medical benefits. Plus, you know, breastfeeding is good for the environment.
No plastic bottles, less waste, you don't need to divert clean drinking water to manufacture it, you don't need to burn fossil fuels to transport it.
Exactly. Plus, you know, the health benefits are real. I mean, the links to higher IQ and less obesity later in life have very little evidence to back them up. But, you know, the short-term benefits.
You mean like preventing necrotizing enterocolitis?
Yeah, that makes a difference. Now, you might say there is no convincing evidence for many of the health claims. And yeah, that is true. But remember, breastfeeding is clearly not worse. It has some benefits. And worst case scenario, it is equivalent to formula. And it's free.
Right. So you may be able to afford buying infant formula, but it's bad for society if people stop breastfeeding, as we saw throughout the 20th century.
Right, and you can't do randomized trials for every possible condition. We have some randomized data showing benefits to breastfeeding and showing that longer breastfeeding is better than shorter breastfeeding. But there are practical limits to what we can study, and sometimes you have to make do with observational research, which, you know, is pretty uniformly supportive of the health benefits, at least for short-term infections like, you know, diarrhea and pneumonia.
Well, shouldn't there be clear randomized trial data before public health agencies make recommendations?
Yes, but I would actually contend that the onus should be not on us to prove that breastfeeding is beneficial, but on the companies that make infant formula to prove that their product is better or as good as breast milk. Remember, breastfeeding is the baseline. They introduced a new product into the market, so the onus should be on them to justify its use.
Yeah, I mean, if it was a new medication, we would ask for proof before it could be prescribed and sold to the public.
Right. Now, in the developed world, if your baby is born at term, it might not make a huge difference if you breastfeed them or bottle feed them. But globally, when you look at it from the public health perspective, breastfeeding has economic, societal, and yes, even healthcare benefits. So if you have to choose between the two options, choose the one that's free.
But if you can't breastfeed for whatever reason, and there are valid reasons.
Yes, of course. And it's probably, you know, it's probably not going to make a huge difference, especially after the first year of life. And while the evidence base may not be everything we want it to be, breastfeeding is likely to be beneficial to some degree for those first few months of life.
So breast is best then?
Overall, yeah. Yeah.
So breastfeed if you can, but maybe don't feel bad if you can't.
Breastfeed if you can, but don't feel bad if you can't.
Breastfeed if you can, but don't feel bad if you can't.
Breastfeed if you can, but don't feel bad if you can't. Breastfeed if you can, but don't feel bad if you can't. Breastfeed if you can. Breastfeed if you can. Don't feel bad if you can't.
When we come back, the race for a vaccine against the novel coronavirus is on, and an old concern is resurfacing. Why is it that some new vaccines are not being compared to a true placebo? We discuss this after the break.
This episode of The Body of Evidence is brought to you in part by these very real quotes from medical doctors and reporters in the Victorian era about what bicycling could do to the human mind and body.
In case within my knowledge, a girl developed exophthalmic goiter as the result of a rather long ride, which she supposed herself able to accomplish without difficulty. This obscure but serious affection is said to be chiefly caused by mental excitement. There is not the slightest doubt that bicycle riding, if persisted in, leads to weakness of mind, general lunacy, and homicidal mania. Men who are apparently mild clergymen or placid physicians will, when mounted on the bicycle, run down other men and women without distinction, and leave them dead or dying on the pavement, without waiting either to help the wounded or to remove the bodies of the dead. There are probably hundreds of bicycle riders in England today, each one of whom has slain from 10 to 20 persons and wounded double that number by driving bicycles over their bodies. The only theory advanced as to the cause, which has been seriously considered, is that it is a result of the effect upon the nervous system of the intense exhilaration rapidly riding brings about. Has anybody ever seen persons on bicycles talking and laughing and looking jolly like persons engaged in any other amusement? Never, I swear!
Welcome back. We got an email from a listener, Randy, about the types of placebos used in vaccines, which is a topic that I wrote about last July. There are people who are concerned, whether they are anti-vaxxers or vaccine hesitant, or even pro-science people who have questions, because they see new vaccines being tested in clinical trials, and they've been taught that you test a new intervention against a placebo, which is something that it looks like the real intervention, but it is inert. And in the case of a vaccine, it would typically be an injection of salt water, what we call saline. But they see that many vaccines, including some of the experimental COVID vaccines, are not being tested against saline, what would be called a true placebo. But they are being tested against other vaccines. So let's explore that. Not every vaccine is the same, right?
No, I mean, there's different types of vaccines and, you know, they're made different ways. So yeah, every vaccine is different. And but it's a fascinating concept because there are people who say that you don't even need a comparator group when you're doing vaccine trials like this. That, you know, the whole idea of a placebo-controlled trial isn't actually necessary in a vaccine setting because the whole population is like your placebo group. So And now they're specifically, okay. Yeah, so it's a fascinating thing. So like, there was one editorial, I think it was in The Lancet, I don't remember where, but there were these researchers were making the argument was that if you're going to talk about vaccine like challenge trials, where you give people a vaccine and then you purposefully expose them to the virus to see if they get sick or not.
Right. These are the so-called human challenge trials, yeah. which some people are pushing for COVID.
Yeah. What they're basically saying is like, well, you don't have to, we don't need a comparator group. You just want to see if these people don't get sick as much. So I'm not sure I completely agree with the argument, but the point is that we know what the infection rate for this virus is, more or less. Mm-hmm. That's maybe debatable. But they're like, for every other thing, like we know that if you get exposed to X, you will get sick. We just need to, see if the vaccine prevents that to a certain degree. So this idea of having a placebo control, even though I personally think that you probably should, not everyone agrees with it. So, that's why you have such heterogeneity. You have some people not doing placebo control trials. You have some people doing true placebo trials. And you have some people who use another vaccine as a comparator, not a placebo. And there's, I guess, arguments to be made for and against each of these things.
Right, because we also have to distinguish between, a vaccine that is the first of its kind, like a vaccine against COVID would be the first, COVID vaccine, but they're also challengers to the throne. So if you have a pre-existing vaccine on the market and then you want to create a new one, comparing it to the placebo would not actually be ethically correct, because you would be depriving your control group of the pre-existing vaccine. So you might want to compare this to the pre-existing vaccine. A vaccine against multiple strains will be compared against a pre-existing vaccine that was against one strain. And sometimes there's a new vaccine that comes on the market, but it's the same as the old one, but there's a new adjuvant in it. So that's a molecule that's in there to trigger a better immune response so that you're better protected. So once again, if there's a pre-existing vaccine on the market, it would not be ethical to withhold that vaccine from the control group to check the new vaccine against a saline placebo.
Right, because you want to make sure this new vaccine is better than what you already have, or at least as good. Now, mm-hmm. where this gets complicated, let's say the first vaccine on the market was not that great, okay? So now you're testing your new vaccine. And so rather than testing it against placebo, you now have to test it against this vaccine that offers only partial effectiveness. You actually need much more people in the trial to show a benefit. Right. So mathematically, sure. It becomes harder to show superiority if you have to compare against another vaccine. And the other problem is, let's say you have an old vaccine, which was pretty good, and you have a new one that maybe isn't quite as good. Well, because the difference between those two things is kind of similar, you can do what's often referred to as a non-inferiority trial, where you're not trying to prove that the new vaccine is superior, you're trying to prove that it's roughly equivalent. So then you might actually get approval for a new vaccine that is not quite as good as the old vaccine, but because you're comparing it against something that's biologically active versus a placebo, it makes it easier to show equivalence. So you end up approving more and more vaccines that are suboptimal. So it gets very, very complicated when you start digging into the whole mechanics of, what's the proper comparator? Because you want to compare something to something else. But choosing that something else is not, it's not actually that easy.
Yeah, when I wrote my piece, and I'll link to it in the show notes, I reached out to Dr. Brian Ward from McGill, who is involved in vaccine research, who is in fact, he has an experimental COVID vaccine in the works. And he told me that in the case of a new disease for which no vaccine currently exists, which is where we are right now with COVID, quote, regulators typically insist that the initial phase 3 studies be conducted with a placebo saline arm to establish absolute vaccine efficacy, end quote. But as he was telling me, this is not ironclad. They insist, right? So scientists will propose a type of placebo that they want to use, and then it's up to the regulators to accept this choice, to refuse it, to make a recommendation for change, or even to insist on a change. I do want to say that there are vaccines that have been compared to saline placebos in the past. There's a common anti-vaxxer argument that it's never been done. That's not true. There were a couple of studies of a quadrivalent HPV vaccine, specifically a 9-valent vaccine with aluminum as an adjuvant, and that was tested against saline. There were studies of measles vaccines, influenza vaccine, rubella. But there are, as we were discussing, there are situations where using saline is unethical. But now we get into a more controversial decision not to use saline, and you might be familiar with there's an experimental COVID vaccine right now called ChAdOx1 and COV19 in the United Kingdom. It is being compared right now to a meningitis vaccine as the quote-unquote placebo. The WHO says it can be valid, especially if its safety is well established, but it may be less acceptable to regulators. And I want to tell you what the team emailed me when I questioned them about this. To get your thoughts on this, because they told me that the reason that they are not testing their experimental COVID vaccine against saline was that saline injections, they say, they don't typically cause a sore arm. So they say that they were worried about blinding being compromised, right? Because in a very good randomized control trial, double-blinded, you don't know if you're getting the real vaccine or if you're getting the placebo. That's called blinding. And so they were worried that you get injected as part of the trial, but if you don't get a sore arm, you may think, that's strange. That's never happened before when I get a vaccine. I must have gotten the placebo. So I'm going to play it safe because I'm probably not protected from the virus. So they were worried about that. And another justification that they gave is about value, which is that when you're injecting someone with saline, there's no value in participating in the trial. There's no value to the individual who's receiving this saline injection. But if you get protection against meningitis, there's value to you. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I understand the reasoning. I'm not sure I agree with it, to be honest with you, because, I mean, in most places, people get these routine vaccinations anyways. So, you know, I mean, I guess I understand the argument for blinding, because it's true. There is this common, there's something that gets repeated very often, that if you inject saline into someone's arm, it causes pain. That's actually not really the case. We've tried that. I've tried that in myself, and it really doesn't hurt if you inject saline just under the skin.
But at the same time, when you look at vaccine trials and have used saline, and you look at the side effects that are reported in the saline placebo arm, you do see people who you know, reports having a sore arm, having pain at the site of injection.
Yeah, I mean, listen, again, when you do this in 10,000 people, yeah, there's probably going to be a small percentage of whom experience pain at that particular place. Maybe it's just a side effect. I mean, listen, I'm sure there is some degree of nocebo response here. I can tell you that the one time I did it in my arm, I didn't feel anything. So take that for what you will. So, I mean, I sort of understand the argument, because especially for a vaccine and a disease like this, where your behavior is really going to influence how likely it is that you're going to get infected. I understand the reasoning behind it. I'm not sure I agree with it. Most vaccines have been, you know, placebo controlled, and that it just intuitively strikes me as the more sort of logical way to approach it. Because the only real downside to doing this, you know, I'm going to compare it to another vaccine that doesn't protect against this thing, because the meningitis vaccine is clearly acting as a placebo. It's not going to prevent COVID, right? Obviously. Right. The only danger is that because there's a certain, you know, level of side effects in the meningitis vaccine, is that your new vaccine is now going to be compared against that for side effects. So if it has as many side effects as the meningitis vaccine, you can say, oh, look, there's no increased harm. I mean, there is a certain degree of increased harm. It's just that the increased harm is comparable to what already exists. And so that's why the regulators have said, well, as long as you choose a vaccine that is proven to be relatively safe, then that's fine. But you don't want to compare it to a vaccine that can cause liver failure, because then you'd be like, well, we had just as much liver failure in that guy. Yeah, but both of you are bad. So the only real downside is, could you be underestimating the side effect profile? But then again, the solution to that is you just pick a vaccine that's relatively safe. And again, when you're talking about controlling a global pandemic where you have a lot of people dying, you know, low levels of side effects are probably not something that we need to excessively worry about, at least in the short term.
All right. When we come back, as we move closer to the end of year one with the coronavirus, the idea that we are overreacting is still with us. Are we? We have a bit of a philosophical discussion after the break. Do you have a question about a study you saw or a headline you read? Is your aunt sending you misinformation on WhatsApp? You can email us at thebodyofevidence@gmail.com. If you want to contribute to our show, head over to patreon.com/thebodyofevidence. For as low as $1 a month, you will gain access to a bonus audio segment each month, and you will help us grow and increase the quality of our work. Welcome to the final stretch of The Body of Evidence. On September 14th, Dr. Lawrence Rosenberg, who is a surgeon by training, who is the executive director of our Jewish General Hospital in Montreal and a well-respected figure in medicine, he stated on television that the coronavirus is probably not much more dangerous than the seasonal flu, and that it affects the very old and those with existing medical conditions. And he caught a lot of flack for this. He then said his statement had been misinterpreted. But this is an argument that's been with us since the beginning of this pandemic. So let's explore that. Are we overreacting?
No. And all you have to do is look at what's happening in the United States right now, and you can see that, you know, a lot of people have died as a consequence of this virus. So, you know, the whole argument of are we overreacting is like, no, I mean, a lot of people died. I can't even wrap my head around the argument that this isn't a big deal. And, you know, people say it's like, well, you know, just as many people die of the flu. I'm like, yeah, but that's pretty bad as well. We work very hard to try to prevent people from dying of the flu. So I'm like, I don't know. Do these people just not care about human life? And like, well, you know, and when people say it's like, well, it's only the old or the people who have pre-existing medical conditions who die. I'm like, yeah, but they are still people. I mean, you know, last time I checked, we are not eugenicists. I mean, I think we fought a war to make sure we didn't become that, you know? So I'm like, I mean, they're still people. And, you know, don't forget, you're going to be old one day too. So, you know, you don't want to be cast aside by society. I think, you know, how our society treats the most vulnerable, how a society treats its most vulnerable members is how you judge a society. So I, just on an emotional gut level, I can't understand the rationale behind this argument.
Yeah, you said about the number of deaths with the flu. I mean, there have been more deaths from COVID-19 than from the flu in that period of time, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even the case fatality rate, if you want to look at it that way, is higher with coronavirus. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is demonstrably higher. Now, it's not 100 times worse. And people are like, well, it's not as bad as the Spanish flu of 1918. And it's like, right, fair. But don't forget, the Spanish flu of 1918, medical science basically didn't exist. You either, you know, in 1918, you either got better on your own or you died. Like, there was nothing that you could do to alter that trajectory. Now, with coronavirus,
it's also interesting because, you know, they'll say, oh, it's not like the 1918 flu, but like, what would have been their opinion in 1918? Because there was an anti-mask league in 1918 in San Francisco. Oh, yeah. I mean, it had weird political ties, but you know, there were people who were opposed to the wearing of masks back then, claiming that all you needed was to go into nature and expose yourself to the sun, and that masks were going to give you disease. So even back then, there were people who were saying, well, it's not like the plague, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's always easy to say, well, it's not as bad as the worst pandemic that I can conjure up in my mind. Therefore, everything is fine.
Right. And again, our medicals, like we have hospitals now, we have ventilators. Like if you develop like a severe pneumonia and can't breathe, we can keep you on a ventilator. We can keep you alive. Like a lot of the people who pulled through of coronavirus did so because they had access to a hospital and to a ventilator. And that's also the problem, is that if we do nothing and the number of cases builds up and, you know, our hospitals become overwhelmed, a lot of people are going to end up dying because there just won't be enough ventilators to go around. So the case fatality rate can go up. Like the case fatality rate is not fixed. It's not as, you know, if it's, you know, 1% or 0.5%, it's not as if it's going to stay at 5%. If all of a sudden the healthcare system starts to break down, the case fatality rate could go up and could become, you know, much, much higher.
Also, being intubated is not necessarily the miracle thing that some people think it is. I mean, aren't there consequences to having been intubated?
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, you know, I mean, a lot of these people end up spending you know, weeks intubated in the ICU. And like a lot of stuff can happen to you when you're intubated. You can get blood clots. You can develop, ulcers just from the act of being in a hospital. You can then get a super infection if you're intubated. Like, you know, bacteria can contaminate the endotracheal tube and you can develop pneumonias. But, you know, even beyond that, just the virus itself leaves scar tissue. If you have a very bad pneumonia and then leaves scar tissue on your lungs, I mean, you won't be able to necessarily breathe as well as you did before. And there's more and more evidence of people having evidence of myocarditis when you scan their hearts afterwards. So the coronavirus is affecting people. So a lot of these people that have residual symptoms, everyone's sort of saying like, oh, what's the cause? And I'm sort of like, well, we don't know specifically, but I mean, the virus is leaving behind consequences, right? So it's not just being alive or dead. You know, you might pull through the virus, but you might, you know, not be quite the same afterwards. It's like having a stroke. You know, people who have a stroke, yeah, you can regain a lot of your functioning of the stroke, but you might never be exactly the same as you were before. You might be, have a little bit of weakness in one leg or not be able to, like, you know, grip with that hand as well as you did before, or maybe have a little bit loss of sight in one eye. So, you know, there can be long-term consequences to getting sick that go beyond death, right? Death is not the only endpoint we have to care about.
Some people bring up the economy, and I'm not going to make an argument about, you know, what capitalism has done to the value of human life. But, you know, they're saying that, you know, we are taking these extreme measures. It's having a devastating impact on our economy. And, you know, just to preserve the life of people who have pre-existing conditions, yada, yada, yada. What I would say is, what if this virus becomes endemic? It just becomes part and parcel of the world of viruses that we deal with. Every flu season, we have this thing that we have to deal with. I mean, is that, was what we did to the economy and to people's businesses worth it if we're just going to have to live with this thing? I mean, I know these are very complex issues to contemplate, but what are your thoughts on this?
Well, here's the thing. I think much of the economy can be preserved. And of course, economies are going to change. Like, I know it. And I feel very bad for people who have brick and mortar stores because, yeah, they've suffered. But, you know, even before this, there was a shift towards, you know, online ordering. Like the brick and mortar store was already under stress, right? Yeah. Movie theaters were under stress from streaming services before this happened.
Sure.
Many restaurants, you know, we're doing increasing amounts of business from takeout and delivery or, you know, yeah. Uber Eats and whatever. And at the beginning of this, I have a friend of mine who owns a restaurant. I said, you know, are you suffering? He's like, no, if anything, we're doing more. During the lockdown, they did more business than they were doing before, but it was all takeout. So a lot of places, the people who are going to be most successful business-wise going forward are the people who are going to be able to pivot. And they might realize like, hey, if we shut down our brick and mortar operations, just have a small kitchen, let's say we're talking about a restaurant, and make our like a takeout thing, yeah, the restaurant experience is going to change and evolve. But the economy always does that. If you're going to be in business, you have to be able to evolve and change. Most offices do not need to bring all their employees to work under one roof. Most people can work from home. And the thing that I think struck me the most about the initial lockdown that we had in the spring was, you know, most people worked from home. And all of a sudden, there were less cars on the road. There was less pollution. And, you know, everyone talks about being in favor of, you know, the environment. But when the solution becomes, well, we just have to stay home and not like commute to work, and all of a sudden there's less, you know, burning of fossil fuels, all of a sudden people are like, no, I need to go to work for my own mental sanity. So it's like, you know, if you care about the environment, maybe we need to rethink how our businesses work, and maybe working from home and telecommuting is a way that we, you know, not only protect ourselves from viruses, but also save money, save time, allow us to spread out the population so that we don't have this concentration.
Dr. Christopher Labos is for the depopulation of the earth. Yeah. You heard it here first, people.
But instead of having these like crowded urban centers, you know, we can allow people to spread out because most people can work from home. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of benefits to this, but we just have to think a little bit outside the box. And I think a lot of people are like, no, we have to go back to things exactly the way they were before. Without realizing, it's like, no, things always change. It's a question of, can we predict that change and can we change with it? Or, you know, do we end up fighting it, which has never historically been a very good strategy?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, you know, what happens with Sweden. Of course, there's been a lot of misinformation about what they did. I mean, they did issue recommendations very close to what we had here in Quebec. They don't have, in the law, they can't have a quarantining of an entire city. So there was no mandated lockdown. They were trying to have a solution that was sustainable. Now cases are rising again as we're recording this. So, yeah, I mean, different countries are dealing with this differently, but...
And the interesting thing about Sweden is that the head of their public health agency later said is like, you know what, we regret the way we handled this at the beginning. So that's often...
especially with the care homes for the elderly, because you know the workers there were complaining early on in the pandemic that they didn't have enough personal protective equipment. And I think they got half of their deaths from care homes for the elderly. So they did not do a good job of protecting these people.
No. I mean, and, you know, I think a lot of people... to be fair, this is the other thing that's sort of interesting. You hear people say, like, well, there was no way to predict this. We had no experience with this. And that's true to an extent. But also, not that long ago, SARS happened, right?
Yeah.
Especially here in Canada. Again, mostly in Toronto. But, we had... A lot of the same issues came up then, and we didn't really learn from it. And I guess we're all a little bit guilty of that. But, 18 years ago, people kind of forgot. And, when people say, we had no game plan in place, I'm like, yeah, fair enough. But, maybe we should, and maybe we should have protocols for what to do when you have, outbreaks of respiratory illnesses. Maybe it shouldn't have caught us as completely by surprise as it did.
But I remember just from watching this conspiracy documentary, Plandemic. I mean, there was just, I think a year ago, there were these simulations that were taking place with representatives from governments and public health agencies around the world. Like, what do we do if there's a pandemic? Mm. So clearly, people were prepared to a certain extent. I mean, we have a public health agency in Canada because of SARS. It didn't exist before then. So there was some level of preparation, and of course I'm not privy to all of that stuff, but it still feels like it's being played, it's being sort of improvised to a certain extent. Maybe I'm not being fair. I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. It's a question of did they have this stuff sort of like worked out in theory but not really in practice? I know a big problem in the U.S. was that they actually cut the funding to their pandemic preparedness office.
That's
right. Trump cut that back. So you can have all the paperwork you want, if you don't have people in place to actually do their job, you can't implement stuff. And I guess stuff is harder in Canada because healthcare is a provincial jurisdiction. So you basically have 10 different provinces, each sort of doing their own thing to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. So I guess there are logistical challenges. But yeah, you would have, I don't know if you remember this. I was actually listening to the episode we did in February, our first block three on the pandemic. When we were talking about it. And it was very interesting to see what we were saying at the time.
What were we saying? I haven't listened to this since then.
I was kind of worried that it was going to be a lot worse than it was. I think we were more or less okay. But it was sort of interesting. We have this new virus coming out of China. We don't really know if it's going to spread here yet. And it's like, oh boy.
Well, it's true. We didn't know.
We didn't know because in February, I think we did this in February and there were no cases in Canada at that point. I think the first case was in March, right? So we were like, it'll spread, maybe it'll won't, we don't really know, let's see what happens. We were talking about it. I remember one of the things that when we first saw what was happening in Northern Italy, and it was like
that was a kicker.
Yeah, and I remember you had asked me, could this happen here? And I was like, I don't think so, because I feel if that happened, I'm like, first of all, I feel like we have enough ventilators, and even if we didn't, I feel like the government would just, pick up a phone and be like, listen, GM plant in Oshawa, I don't know if there's a GM plant in Oshawa anymore, but GM plant in Oshawa, stop making cars, start making ventilators, click, right? Uh-huh. And that didn't happen. I mean, it happened eventually, but it took, months before that was worked out. And that, again, knowing nothing about the government preparedness, because the prime minister doesn't confide in me, I was kind of surprised that there wasn't push button here to make ventilators plan in place, which I would have thought there should have been, right? There I would have thought it would have been relatively easy for the government to have a pathway to manufacture stuff if needed, and relatively simple stuff like visors is basically just a sheet of plastic you like glue to a headband. Like, yeah, you can make that at home. It surprised me that it was hard for that to happen quickly.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we I suppose, you know, if you think about this, if we were in that position, it would be very easy to have this whole plan in place. And then as soon as you see the outbreak, you press the button and then the whole thing starts to fall into place. But there must be inertia in that system that makes it so that a lot of people are hesitant, because you are upsetting. I mean, you're taking over factories, right? It's the government barging in and saying, you are going to stop doing the thing that you want to do, and now you're going to work for us. Yeah. And you don't want to do that for no good reason.
Right.
And these you don't know in advance there's going to be a pandemic. You don't know how it's going to spread exactly. You don't know which province is going to be more affected than the other. So there are just so many variables along the way that I can imagine why there are these delays. I mean, I'm not sure that all of the delays are justified, but I can imagine that it doesn't play the way that it does in a simulation.
Well, there's an old saying is that everything you do before a pandemic seems like an overreaction, and everything you do after a pandemic seems like you didn't go far enough.
Yeah.
And this is the problem, right? I mean, we had a rather strict lockdown in this country, not as strict as other countries, but stricter than most.
Yeah.
You know, fairly widespread, fairly universal. And then you get people saying like the stuff we said, like, well, this was an overreaction. You're like, yeah, but you don't know what the counterfactual argument was. You don't know how bad things would have been here if we hadn't locked down. You know, people are saying is like, well, there weren't that many deaths, therefore the lockdown was unnecessary. It's like, no, it's the reverse of that. We probably had less deaths. I mean, and if you want an example, I mean, just look to the US where they didn't lock down. They've had a lot. They have, you know, their mortality rates are much higher than ours.
But Trump says, you know, I deserve an A for this. And as soon as we get a vaccine, I'm going to get an A+. It's very good.
I mean, it's very troubling. Like, you know, here's the thing. Remember, so that video that you sent me.
Which one? The puppy one?
No, not the puppy one. The puppy ones make me happy. No, the one about the how the virus is not as bad as the flu. The one that we got forwarded by... Let me pull up.
If it wasn't today, my brain has erased it, because that's how time works now in the days of the event. There was a video that I saw at some point. Yeah, probably.
The one sent to us by Jason.
Oh, this. Okay. Yeah. So this is a video that's been making the rounds. And here's the thing. So as a science communicator, and I'm sure it's the same thing for you, sometimes somebody sends you a 45-minute video somebody who is probably a crank who has put together a whole video presentation with slides that argue against, you know, what you know about the virus. And then the person in the email asks you, what do you think of this?
Yeah.
And it's like, I appreciate that you're sending this to me. I don't have time to watch a 45. I was watching hours and hours of this, you know, really insane psychiatrist for an article that I was writing. But anyway, yeah. So that video was making the rounds. Apparently that video was being watched by higher ups in important universities in Quebec and who were agreeing with it. Yeah. And the guy was making the case that, you know what, this pandemic, it's not as bad as we think it is, and we're overreacting.
Well, I mean, one of the thing, I mean, I watched a bit of it and then I had to stop because it was making me angry, but he kept referring to the people who died as like dry tinder. And those were the terms he actually used. And his argument was that because the previous flu season was relatively mild, the people who would have died last year were still alive this year, and they just got picked off by the virus. They were like the dry tinder that makes a forest fire worse. And regardless of the math, which I have issues with the statistics, and I think I could demonstrate, again, if I had like oodles and oodles of free time, I could make my own PowerPoint presentation to show you like, no, this is pretty bad. But... just again, to get back to one of the points I made earlier, to refer to other human beings as dry tinder and that their deaths were somehow of no consequence is a little horrifying to me, because like, how do you refer to other people that way? Like, it's really, I don't know, but it's like, and that's the thing, like, you watch these videos, you can easily become seduced by the numbers, and you're like, no, wait a minute. At the most basic level, I look at Canada, I look at the US, Canada's done relatively well, not as good as we could have done, but relatively well, and the US is, you know, basically a disaster. I feel like our course of action was probably the right one. We'll never know what the, you know, alternate universe where we didn't do X, Y, and Z was, but I would argue that it's always better to overreact a little and save lives than to underreact and, you know, have to bury more people.
Yeah, but unfortunately there is this, you know, long tradition of people of a certain philosophical bend who see everything that happens as personal responsibility, right? So if you get sick, well, it's your fault.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, it's a known bias in psychology known as the fundamental attribution error, which is where you think that when bad things happen to you, it was outside of your control. But when bad things happen to other people, it was their choice, their behavior, and they deserved it somehow. And there are people who commit this error a lot more than others. And so it's very easy to think that, you know, if you get the coronavirus, well, it was somebody else's fault. You know, they gave it to you. You were an upstanding citizen who did not deserve it. But if somebody else gets the coronavirus, well, you know, they had pre-existing conditions and they're not eating well and they're not exercising and they're not in tip-top shape. So therefore, they deserve it, which is very inhumane, I think.
No, agreed. Completely agree.
We want to thank our patrons as always. We want to thank Hidetomo Katsura for upping their pledge, and we want to welcome the following new patrons to our Body of Evidence family: Laura Cruz, Jonathan Sigmund, Paulina, and Marion Goldine. And a big thank you to all of our patrons at the $5 or more level, and they are Jeff Brown, Alan Matthews, Frank R., Islan Wolf MD, Matthew Jacob, Ken Hale, Jeff Gelbach, Cabe Speary, Luis O'Neill, Juan Giabraldes, Leanne Simons, That Montreal Guy, Mary Ellen James, Paul DeHaunt, Pascal Levesque, Cordelia Naismith, Eric Johnson, Thunk, Beverly, Helen Sue, Michael McAvoy, Lunaterra, Ryan Armstrong, Janice Stevenson, Stevie Shapiro, Trimman Cassidy, Kay Dennis, Bill Wingerak, Rena Skaski, Nolan Archer, Chris Roos, Paul Clements, Neil Lima, Mike, Jean-Nicola Derap, Tal Sharabi Shur, Laura Cruz, and Marion Goldine. Thank you. If you want to join these fine people, go to patreon.com/thebodyofevidence. Every patron, no matter how much money they give us, even a dollar a month, they get a bonus segment each month. And your bonus segment this month is
some very valid reasons why some moms can't breastfeed. And if we have time, a trivia question: what isn't in breast milk that you actually need?
And that's the end of our show this month. Our jingle was composed and performed by Joseph Hackle. You can find his music at josephhackle.bandcamp.com. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The show itself can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and Stitcher. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy. Proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at
the body of evidence.
Breastfeed if you can.